Their unwritten language has been called the only truly unbreakable code in modern military history. How important were the Navajo code talkers in World War II? We'll find out from a Visalia man who served with them.
Without the code talkers, they played a tremendous part in our winning the war, I think.
Catch this 92-year-old Marine Corps veteran on Hometown Heroes today at 1 on News Talk 580 or 5 p.m. on FM 105.9 KMJ.
News Talk 580 KMJ presents Hometown Heroes, honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes with you every Saturday on KMJ. Each week we visit with World War II veterans, and this week we're in Visalia. If you've hung out around Visalia Country Club, maybe you've run into Bud Erickson, who's going to tell us quite a story that not too many can tell. But before we get to the Navajo code talkers and some of the close calls you had, let's talk about where you were on December 7th, 1941. What do you remember about finding out that America had been attacked?
I was in Minneapolis at the time, and I'd been out playing baseball. We had a big lot near the house. When I came in, my stepdad said, "Bud, be quiet, sit down, listen to the radio." And the announcement came that Pearl Harbor had been bombed. So that's where I was at the time.
And you had just celebrated your 22nd birthday the week before that.
November 30th, I'd celebrated my birthday.
What were your plans for life at that point? What were your ambitions? What do you think you were going to be doing?
Well, at that time, actually, I was working. I had a job with a manufacturer's rep in Minneapolis. I was on the city desk, and I had hopes of advancing, perhaps being a salesman, and going on from there.
But that news of Pearl Harbor had an impact on you, changed your mind?
Oh, it did it with the majority of all of us. It was exciting, really. It wasn't a case of... Actually, you look back at the kids that came from South Dakota and the Midwest. They got off the farm. It was a big adventure. I told my girlfriend, "Well, I'll be home." We were talking about getting married at the time. I said, "No, I'll be home in a year and we'll get married then." Well, it didn't work out that way. But typically, we all felt that, my gosh, this is excitement. We're going to join. Mm-hmm. It wasn't so much that we were going to save the world, but we were going to get in this in one way or the other. And that's the way most of us felt.
And what made you decide that you wanted to be one of the few, the proud, the Marines?
Well, I think I saw a couple of Marines in Minneapolis in their dress blues, and I thought that looked pretty exciting. So actually, there were eight of us that were friends from either high school or work, and we all went down together on December 18th. We filled out all the formalities, but we were told to go home, stand by. They were getting pre-war, old World War I railroad cars. There was an extreme shortage of cars at that time to get move people, move enlistees out to the West Coast or the East Coast. So they told us to stand by, and then I got word to come down. January 5th, we were sworn in, went aboard a train, and headed for San Diego.
So within a month of Pearl Harbor, you were already headed to San Diego and being indoctrinated into the Marine Corps. What was that like? What did it take to toughen you up and turn you into a Marine?
You don't join the Marine Corps. You join and then you become a Marine. And let me tell you, at that time, boot camp was a lot tougher than it is now. They don't allow some of the things that were done. By that, I mean, we used to get banged around a little bit, you know, if we got out of line. And there were some cases that they went a little too far, but that's the way it was. What they did, I think the philosophy was to bring you down to the lowest level they could and then bring you back up. And at the end of boot camp, we were all marching good. We fired the rifle range. A lot of us from Minnesota had hunted a lot. We had a bet on with the guys from Texas that were in our... We beat them on the rifle range, but they beat us in the individual marksman. The best marksman was a Texas boy, but we beat the overall. But getting back to boot camp, it was 6 weeks of a tough deal. For example, we get pulled out at 2 a.m. with a full combat pack and maybe go 12 miles or 14 miles. And I swear I was in the best shape I've ever been in my life when I got out of boot camp.
Was it a relief to be done with that? Did you feel like you had accomplished something?
Definitely, yeah. It was. We were anxious to find out where we were going, what they were going to do with us. And boot camp was just the preliminary. We were all anxious. It was a relief. Although we hated those DIs, hated their guts. But when it was over, we loved them. And really, we had two great guys. When it was all over, we were all buddies. So.
And DI is a drill instructor, and typically those were guys from the old breed, as they called them, the Marines who had been sometimes through World War One.
We had two DIs. Our head DI was what they call a China Marine. Back in 37, 38, times were tough. Kids got out of high school. A lot of them joined the Marine Corps. And most of them ended up in China, and they were known as China Marines. They had a special khaki they wore that you could tell them right away. But in any event, this one had DI, and he was tough. He was really tough.
You were 22, which I think we think of as a very young man and someone who hasn't experienced that much, but you were probably training with guys a lot younger than you, huh?
I would say the average age of the Marines in the various, particularly early in the war, was probably 17 to 18, with an average of 17 and a half. I was in the hospital up at Silver Stream in New Zealand. There's a kid 15 years old. He lied about his age. What he did, he forged the application, and his grandmother signed it. He said he was 16, and if you were 16 and you got your parents, well, he lived with his grandma, but here was a 15-year-old. He lost a leg below the right knee, and he was in the bed next to mine. He got discharged honorably and was awarded. I think he got the Silver Star for some heroics on Guadalcanal.
At all of 15. But because you were 22, they had a nickname for you. What was that?
They called me Pop. Although I didn't look 22. I used to have to show my ID card. We'd go into the Grand Hotel in San Diego. It was quite a hangout during the war. And every time we'd go in, I'd have to show an ID that I was old enough to drink. Mm-hmm. And I was assigned to the 2nd Division in San Diego at Camp Elliott. They were forming the 2nd Division. The division has 17,000 men. And they were up to about 12,000. So when they finally formulated the division, they left from Camp Elliott. Camp Pendleton didn't exist when we were down in San Diego. We were at the old Marine Corps base and also out in the boondocks. Out at Camp Elliott.
So you're part of the 2nd Marine Division, and you were part of the first major offensive against the Japanese in the Pacific at Guadalcanal. Tell me about the build-up to that, what you were experiencing. Were you scared? Were you anxious? Were you eager to get into some action?
Anybody in combat for the first time that says he wasn't scared, he's not telling the truth. Believe me. Well, I wasn't an infantryman. I was Signal Company, 2nd Division, attached to headquarters. Our responsibilities were communications from headquarters is the general, his staff, down to regiment, four regiments and also special battalion. So we had a big job, and that entailed what we call the wire section. That's telephone, switchboard. Combat, it's laying a lot of wire between regiment and headquarters, regiment down to battalion, regiment up to the forward OP. That's the forward outpost. So, but getting back to the first offensive, I didn't go in on the initial landing. I came in at a later date with, there were about eight of us brought in at night, and we had two code talkers, Navajo code talkers, that were needed. So, there was bombing every night. The combat was awfully heavy, but we weren't, as I say, I wasn't an infantryman, so we were getting shot at just like everybody else. but we weren't up there in the front position. You take Europe, had huge front lines. That didn't take place. The jungle was a jungle, and your front line might have been 50 yards from the enemy, or 100 yards, or 500 yards. So it was a much different type of combat.
You mentioned the Navajo code talkers, and they were needed. And some people might be familiar about it. There have been books written, movies made about that unique group and the role that they played. But for people who've never heard anything about this before, explain to us who the Navajo code talkers were and why they were so important.
It was discovered early in the war, actually at the outbreak of the war, the Japanese were breaking our codes, we were breaking their codes. The best means of communicating in combat is by radio, but it's the most dangerous. It can be, the code can be broken down. And it was discovered that the Navajo language was impossible. You didn't have to code it, but sometimes we did code it. So that was double coding if something really. But in any event, most of the Navajos that we were involved with came from the Phoenix area or Arizona. And in our headquarters, we had six at first, and then we had eight later on. And they were dispersed during combat to different areas where they were needed. They were an independent group of boys. They pretty much stayed within their own circle of. I got along well with them, so I was assigned to work with them on many occasions, on Saipan and Guadalcanal. When we went up to Okinawa, we had a couple, but I went ashore in Okinawa, but they pulled me back to go back to Saipan and instruct.
Basically, the idea was because their language could not be duplicated, could not be understood by the Japanese, that you basically had an unbreakable code. And what was the strategic impact of that? What did it allow to happen that wouldn't have happened otherwise?
It allowed the Marine units to get messages out rapidly. And a lot of those messages were really played a part in a successful campaign where they accomplished. And without the code talkers, they played a tremendous part in our winning the war, I think. I really do, because of the importance in their ability to get messages to Hyden. I can't stress enough the importance of the Navajos.
Well, and about a decade ago, Congress finally recognized that importance. In 2001, the code talkers received the Congressional Gold Medal. There's a lot of great info online about this topic. If you go to kmjnow.com, I have a link to the official Navajo Code Talkers website. They're actually raising money to build a Code Talkers Museum. Their language is billed as the only unbreakable code in modern military history. How did you interact with them? How did your duties allow you to work with them?
Well, it wasn't a case when you say work with them. Let's start with going on liberty. Not only the Navajos, but they sometimes had a little more problem when they'd go on liberty and have a little too much beer to drink or what have you. And I would often go into Wellington on liberty and keep an eye on the Navajos from our group. And we did have a real incident one night. We had a Navajo named Damon, and his buddy was Rory Begay. Damon was an ex-Golden Glove champ from the reservation outside of Phoenix, and Begay, Roy, was a very skinny little kid, and apparently somebody was picking on him in a bar in Wellington, and the fight broke out. And the next thing you know, the fight broke outside, and the military police, which is Army, came, and Damon took care of two of them, and they got another one, and finally he was hit behind the head, and they took him into the brig. I went down to the brig and talked to the Army captain and explained to him that it was very important that I take these two boys, I take them back to camp. He said, no way, they're staying. So I said, can I use your phone? I got our colonel, I ran him down. And when he got through talking to the captain, the boys were released, and I took them back to camp. But when you say working with them, I didn't, other than if they were to be taken up to a certain position, oftentimes that'd be my job to take them up there. If they didn't like you, it's hard to get them to go along with what you wanted to do. But for the most part, there was very little trouble in that direction. They were tremendous good boys.
But if you hadn't bailed them out, then may have missed on an opportunity to communicate. It was clear that their strategic importance was big enough that bailing them out was a priority.
They would have been bailed out, I guarantee you, because it's a national.
But their role was important enough that...
Very much so, very much so.
Has it been, because I'm sure when you came back from the war, this not a lot of people knew who the Navajo Code Talkers were. So in recent years, when it's been more publicized and they've been honored, has that been fulfilling for you to see them get that recognition?
Very much so. I often wonder, there's a big gay that's a good friend of Tiger Woods. He's a PGA golfer. And I often wondered if he might be a grandson of Roy Begay, my friend. But I also found out, like Smith, there's hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of Begays, so I don't know. But yes, it was very fulfilling. And I became friends with a Navajo Code Talker who came to Tulare every year and talked to the high school. He also talked to COS. He just died here about 4 or 5 months ago. There's an article in the paper.
Well, I imagine some people listening might be wondering, well, if you worked with these Navajo Code Talkers, did you ever get them to teach you any of that language, any phrases in Navajo?
I knew a couple, and I could say them, but I won't tell you what they meant. If they didn't like somebody, they would say, Nishki. I knew a few other words, but not many.
But if we translated them, we'd have to bleep it out, is what you're saying.
Bleep it, right. There's a very interesting part of the comparatively new National Marine Corps Museum, and they have a tremendous area where you can press a button and a Navajo comes on the air, his picture. He talks to you in Navajo, and underneath it are the, it's transcribed in English. Great part of the museum.
And again, you heard me mention there is also an effort to build a Navajo Code Talkers Museum. You can find more about that online at kmjnow.com, and you'll get more of Bud Erickson's story when Hometown Heroes continues next on KMJ.
A high school where 98% of graduating seniors go to college, where success on the SAT and advanced placement or AP classes outpaces almost every other school in the valley. Home to a student newspaper that hauls in national awards on an annual basis. Its sports teams capture section championships. Have you figured it out yet? The school is Fresno Christian, and it's not just a high school. Fresno Christian offers a complete K-12 curriculum delivered by supremely qualified, experienced teachers who connect with their students personally, intellectually, and spiritually. Go to FresnoChristian.com to learn more about the value of a truly Christ-centered education. And if you want to see for yourself, call 299-1695 to schedule a campus visit. Whether it's kindergarten, high school, or anywhere in between, you'll get a genuine feel for what Fresno Christian's commitment to excellence could mean for your student. That number again, 559-299-1695. Fresno Christian Schools, education with a higher purpose.
On the front line of freedom, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. 92-year-old Bud Erickson of Visalia, our guest today. He served in the 2nd Marine Division during World War II. He has shared with us his involvement with Navajo Code Talkers, even how he had to bail a couple of them out after a fight. Well, you would end up with a close call on Guadalcanal, but I don't think you saw it coming because they had told you the island was secure, the fighting was over?
Well, no. It's routine that you're going to get bombed. The island's secured, but that doesn't mean that you're not going to have air raids. So we knew that, not a possibility, we knew they were coming at different times, but we just didn't expect them, or we hoped they wouldn't come at the time we were playing baseball out there.
Yeah, tell me about that. So here you are, you're in the middle of a war. You're on Guadalcanal, of all places, where there's been so much written and told about what the Marines did there. And you're playing a baseball game. What position were you playing?
Third base. And I played third base after the war was over for American Legion baseball. Baseball was a big thing when take Saipan, for instance. When that island was secured, and that was a long, drawn-out program, they probably had 10, 12 baseball fields that the Seabees, and they had inner Army, Navy, Marine, even the Seabees got in on it. They built the ball fields, or the Army engineers. But it was a great part of And as far as you expected air raids, we got them on Saipan. The island was secured eventually, but they came in. They loved to come in on special holidays. I remember Christmas of 1944, about 14 Mitsubishis and a couple other medium bombers came in. Fortunately, we had a forewarning, and the P-38s and the P-40s, mostly P-38s were up there, and they knocked down, I'd say, all but two. And we were about a half a mile away from Isley Field, was the big field in Saipan, where Major LeMay had the B-29s flying out every morning. Well, anyway, they came in and they caught about eight B-29s on the ground. They demolished probably two or three, and the rest were beat up pretty bad. They were able to repair them later, but it's something you expected. We had washing machine Charlie. He came over every night all by himself, and you could tell he had an engine that you could tell. You knew when he was coming. He'd probably be up at 20,000 feet, and it was a harassment. The island was practically secured, and you had cots. You were sleeping in cots by then. Right. But he'd come over. The air raid warnings would go off. Out of the sack you'd get, all it was harassment.
So you're giving us a taste of what life was like there. Take us back to that baseball game on Guadalcanal, because you're playing third base, and here come the Bombers, but it's not the Bronx Bombers. It's not Gehrig or Babe Ruth or DiMaggio. This was Japanese bombers, and they were trying to blow up your ball game.
Yes, they were, and they did. As I told you, they killed the first baseman, and they killed a couple of guys in the foxhole we were in, and that's the way it was.
So bombs are dropping, bullets are flying, and you go find some place to hide.
The four of us jumped in this. This foxhole previously was a Japanese foxhole. It was bigger than the average, deeper. Two of us one end, two of us the other end. The two on the far end got killed where the bomb was closer to them. And we were blown out, but we weren't killed. We both eventually recovered.
Does that seem like a close call to you?
It was as close as I want to come. I had quite a few close calls, and that was one of them.
And you didn't exactly want your mother to get a telegram saying, Bud died playing baseball.
That's right. That'd be embarrassing.
Well, and you can joke about it now, but at the time, when you're living with this every day, with the threat of being shot or blown up, of not making it home, how did you deal with that? How did you face each new day believing that you were going to make it through?
It's hard to elaborate on that. We didn't think a lot about it. I didn't anyway. It's always the other guy that's going to get it, you know. So I really didn't. When I still feel that way, when the bell rings, it rings, and it's your time to. So I can't say I went through most days I didn't think of it. When there was some heavy combat going on, you hope like the devil that there wasn't one with your name on it. But I can't elaborate on that too much as to worrying about it, if you understand what I'm trying to say.
When it's always the other guy, sometimes that other guy is somebody that you know, somebody that maybe even you let yourself get close to. Did you ever have to deal with that? And how did you handle guys dying around you?
Well, it's always tough to see a buddy go. After a while, you got used to Marines around you getting killed. The hardest part was if it was a friend that you'd been with for a year, 2 years, maybe longer. You had to deal with it, and that was it. There was nothing you could do about it. After the war was over, I went to see the parents of three friends of mine that got killed that I enlisted with. But from the standpoint of worrying about it every day, I wouldn't say that was a big issue.
Anything else from Guadalcanal that stands out in your memory that you experienced and still sticks with you all these years later?
The smell of death is something you never forget, particularly when there's 200 or 300. it permeates your dungarees, and it takes a while to, so it's not a very pleasant subject or a pleasant experience. There's a good book that was written, My Helmet is My Pillow. I've got it. I'll give it to you if you really want to. He was a machine gunner with the 1st Division, enlisted the same time I did. Heck of a book.
And you weren't only up against the enemy. In many times, the weather was a factor. In your case, I think the potential of illness was a great challenge. Malaria, dengue. How brutal were some of these things?
Well, malaria is the Anopheles mosquito that was prevalent on all the islands. Eventually, they laid out grids and they sprayed, but the first early campaigns, they didn't have that program going. We took Adabrin every day. That's a preventative. Right. Once you get it, then it's quinine, but quinine was a treatment. When the malaria hit you, you could feel it coming. You knew it was coming. First, there was the chills for maybe 10, 15 minutes. Then you had about 2 hours of extreme high temperature and perspiration and a weakness. You were pretty much out of commission. There were an awful lot of, I don't know how many thousand Marines. Some had it worse than others. I had it bad. I really got it bad. I had it in civilian life after the war. I had probably 8 or 10 attacks after the war.
And you, I don't know if you were joking or not, but you told me you thought in your outfit you had the record.
I know that I had 32 attacks between Saipan and Guadalcanal. One interesting story about Guadalcanal, Vandegrift was the commanding general of the 1st Division who landed. And I served under him while I was on the island. So Thanksgiving came of 1942, and they decided to fly in turkeys and have a nice Thanksgiving dinner. So a bunch of New Zealand medium bombers brought in, I don't know how many, hundreds of turkeys for the division. And they fixed this wonderful dinner, turkey, asparagus, mashed potatoes, gravy. We had our mess gear, and we got all of that dinner in the mess gear. But about 4 hours later, 2/3 of the division came down with tropical dysentery. Either the turkey or something went bad. And it was a serious situation. There was an investigation made because that whole division was inoperative. They were sick as a pup. I'm not sure whether Vandegrift got it or not, but I know a lot of his staff came down with it.
Well, it sounds like with that and 32 bouts of malaria and dengue fever that you spent a lot of your time not feeling very good.
Well, when you say a lot of time, you'd get it at 8 o'clock, we'll say, on a Monday morning, and by Wednesday you were back on duty. So, yes, you did lose a lot of time that way.
Lose a lot of weight, too?
32 over a period of 2.5 years overseas. Well, in the hospital, I went from 138 down to 97 pounds. And I was sent home from Silverstream, New Zealand, to San Diego Hospital, the main hospital. And then 10 months later, I rejoined my outfit, and we went to Saipan.
Was that hard for you to have to leave under those conditions and then rejoin them later?
Not a bit. I was glad. I really was.
Sure. It's safe in San Diego.
I enjoyed the time I had in San Diego. All of us that came home, you know, if you wore a ribbon, you know, you couldn't buy a drink. People couldn't do enough. Even in San Diego, a military town. But I went home on a 30-day convalescent leave to Minneapolis, and you can't believe how wonderful they were. They're just terrific.
You had to leave all that behind and go back to the Pacific. And you're on Saipan, which I've heard a lot about, but a lot of people haven't heard too much about Saipan. It gets overshadowed with everything that happened at some of the other islands. What do you remember about what happened there and what you witnessed?
Saipan was a strategic island because they finally got an airport, and they were flying B-29s from Saipan, bombing Japan, and returning. A lot of them, with trouble, didn't make it back, and that's where Iwo Jima came in. they could land. That was a short hop from Japan to Iwo. But anyway, Saipan was a big island. The village of Garapan, we were located just a little south of Garapan, was a village. They grew crops. The natives were very civilized, a lot of them quite intelligent. Interesting thing, they grew vegetables you wouldn't believe. Cabbage twice the size of a basketball, or is bigger than a basketball. When the island was secured, the Army engineers built a freeway, the first of the freeways, I think, that were ever built. It was six lanes, coral, and it went from Isley Field to the other end of the island where the Army headquarters were. They came in after the island was pretty much secured, and they took over and established the island. My son-in-law, Mark Lewis from Lewis Travel, was in Saipan a few years ago, and he brought me pictures and a map. Now it's a resort area like Hawaii to Japan. They have 8 or 10 luxury hotels there. But Saipan was a long, drawn-out campaign.
And what kinds of things were you doing there?
Same thing, communications. I was in codes and ciphers also. And we would set up coding. We had a little, I forget the number of the machine. It had 26 wheels. And we could set up code messages on that if we weren't using the Navajos, where it wasn't high security.
Working with codes and ciphers and having kind of this information that was clearly sensitive, or else you wouldn't need to code it, did that make you feel like your task was important? Did it give you a sense of, I'm doing something worthwhile and meaningful here?
Oh, very much so. Every Marine felt what he was doing was darn important, from the infantryman on up. And our job was naturally important. We were responsible for communications from the general and his staff down to regiment.
Any more close calls that you think back on?
There were about 4 of us on Saipan. The island wasn't quite secured yet. And one of the biggest problems, Japanese sharpshooters would infiltrate at night, get themselves up in a tall palm tree and tie themselves in. We lost a lot of men that way. And there were 3 of us that got pinned down. And I remember I had a shot creased my helmet, and I ducked down. I got a mirror and held the mirror up, and we were trying to get a line on where he was, and he shot twice, and 2 of the guys, I'm holding 2 of the guys, one of them had an M1 and the other one had an O3 Enfield, and we didn't hear anymore. They must have got him, so we don't worry about that. That happened 2 or 3 times, but it was just a case of where you had to be careful. The snipers got a lot of Marines, Army, that way.
No doubt. You know, nearly 3,500 Americans died on Saipan, over 7,000 at Guadalcanal. Later, you'd end up for a while on Okinawa, where over 12,000 Americans were killed and nearly 40,000 more wounded. A heavy, heavy price was paid for that victory in the Pacific. When we come back, we'll hear what Bud remembers about the end of the war and also what he did to honor one of the more than 400,000 Americans who were killed in action during World War II. This is Hometown Heroes on KMJ. Who's counting down the days till football season? Well, I am. The Fresno State Bulldogs kick off September 1st. That's 56 days from now. Paul Leffler here, and you know, a lot of people ask me what I do when there aren't any Fresno State games to announce. Well, I'll tell you, some of my favorite local events are in the offseason, the summer. My daughters love watching the pole vaulters at the Old Town Clovis Farmers Market. That's coming up August 3rd. I'm a big fan of the Fig Fest, marked down August 11th for that one, and I would love to have you join me on Thursday night, July 19th at Pardini's in Fresno. One of the top sports announcers in the business is speaking, and ladies, his wife is too, so you might want to hear this. Her name is Hallie, his name is Dave Pasch, radio voice of the NFL's Arizona Cardinals, and TV announcer of college football, NBA basketball, and more on ESPN. They'll talk football, family, and faith, and that buffet dinner at Pardini's is just $10 a person. Call 559-225-5095. That's 225-5095, or go to cbmcfresno.com. Sportscaster Dave Pasch and his wife Hallie, Thursday, July 19th at 6 p.m. I'll see you there.
A high school where 98% of graduating seniors go to college, where success on the SAT and advanced placement or AP classes outpaces almost every other school in the Valley. Home to a student newspaper that hauls in national awards on an annual basis. Its sports teams capture section championships. Have you figured it out yet? The school is Fresno Christian, and it's not just a high school. Fresno Christian offers a complete K-12 curriculum delivered by supremely qualified, experienced teachers who connect with their students personally, intellectually, and spiritually. Go to FresnoChristian.com to learn more about the value of a truly Christ-centered education. And if you want to see for yourself, call 299-1695 to schedule a campus visit. Whether it's kindergarten, high school, or anywhere in between, you'll get a genuine feel for what Fresno Christian's commitment to excellence could mean for your student. That number again, 559-299-1695. Fresno Christian Schools, education with a higher purpose.
Hey, this is Paul Leffler, and if you've been listening to KMJ for any length of time, you've probably heard me wax poetic about my hometown of Las Banas at one point or another. Every city has its secrets, and I'm going to fill you in on one my old neighbors have been keeping for 40 years. No matter where you live in the valley, you probably go through Las Banas every once in a while. So next time you're cruising down the 152, pull into Ming's Restaurant. The owner, Paul Cito, has been showing off his skills in the kitchen there since 1968. He has perfected the best Mongolian beef this side of the Great Wall. Delicate rice noodles underneath tender slices of beef with a flavor I can't even put into words. Whether you prefer mild, medium, or spicy, you'll be coming back for more. Ming's is closed on Mondays, so don't say I didn't warn you. But stop in any other day and try the pork wonton soup, Chinese chicken salad, or get everyone's attention with the sizzling chicken and vegetables. The possibilities are endless, but they all have one thing in common. Ming's time-tested commitment to taking your taste buds on a thrill ride. Ming's Restaurant, 435 West Pacheco Boulevard in Las Banas.
This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty on 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. Visiting today with 92-year-old Bud Erickson of Visalia. He served with the 2nd Marine Division in World War II. Another veteran from that division joins us next week. That's Claire Slaughter, who won 4 state championships as the football coach at Fresno City College. I look forward to that. But right now, let's come down the home stretch with Bud Erickson.
Did you get a sense as the end drew near that the end was near? Did you hear about the first bomb at Hiroshima and have any reaction to that?
Very much so. I came back from aboard ship at Okinawa to instruct. And after a couple of weeks, we started to hear rumors that something big was going to happen. And they got more and more each day. And the rumors were coming over from Tinian. Tinian is a little island 8 miles from Saipan. Well, finally, I went over one day to pick up a couple of recruits coming in. They'd just gotten out of boot camp. They were assigned. One was a code talker, so I went over to pick him up and 3 other guys. We got no information over there, but there was a lot of activity going on, and we couldn't get near certain areas. They were restricted. But then the bomb was dropped on Hiroshima. The whole island of Saipan went into celebration. The southern boys could take any kind of fruit, raisins, apricots, prunes, and they could make what we called raisin jack. Or a keg of nails, and that whole island celebrated for a couple of days. A lot of hangovers.
And now you know that Tinian is where those B-29s took off from to drop the bombs on both Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And Nagasaki is someplace that you had to go, and it was not long after that atomic bomb was dropped there. How did that happen? How'd you end up in Nagasaki?
I worked with a colonel for about 3 years. Wonderful guy. He was our head of our comm. We called it COM, Communication Unit. So when the war ended, I had a lot of points. We went home on point system. I was called in to see him. Sarge said, I've been assigned to go to Nagasaki and open a communication office, and I need a communication chief. Would you consider going? I had no dependents. My girlfriend got married, so I was a loner.
And you had gotten a Dear John letter, so you knew?
Very much so. I got one. Anyway, I said I'd be glad to go, Colonel. And he said, you can pick the men you want. He gave me a list of about 30. Well, in our comm group, we had about 10, including myself. I made 11. And we opened a communication office at the Jima Wharf, which is in the Mitsubishi Harbor. And our comm office was right off the water, and Mitsubishi built a lot of ships there. It was like Sausalito. Our assignment was there, and it wasn't long that we got the office going, and every morning a little Japanese girl would come. I would say she was about 6, maybe 7, cute as a bug. Those little Japanese girls that steal your heart. She would come, and she had a little one-sheet newspaper that they printed, and she'd say, "Ohio," and I'd bow, and I'd say, "Ohio," which is good morning, and she'd give me this. And I would go back into these warehouses were full of everything, ammunition, rifles, food stuff. So I'd fill a big bag of food and give it to her, and off she'd go home. Well, a few days later, she came with an elderly gentleman, handsome. I would guess he was about 60 then. I said, "Ohio," and he said, "Ohio." And I said, "Excuse my Japanese. We all gained enough Japanese we could get by roughly." He said, "Don't worry about it. I speak perfect English." He spoke better English than we did. He had formerly had a business in L.A., and he was a exotic jewelry. He made and he did some for the royal family, and he used to export to L.A. He had two people running the L.A. office, and he would come to Los Angeles quite often. So he was very much, he was pro-U.S. In fact, he was investigated for the fact that he had an office in L.A. that he might be. But he had four boys, three were killed, and he had three daughters and a whole bunch of grandchildren. And I was invited to dinner quite often. The first thing he did was take your shoes off, and your kimono was hanging on a hook there. We became very, very close friends, and when the time came for me to go home, I took a train from Nagasaki to Sasebo. That was the debarkation point for the ship that I was going to go on, and when it came time to board the train, the whole Yazaki family came. Each one had a gift. To this day, I still have some of them. A set of cultured pearls, some beautiful silk kimonos, some inlaid mother-of-pearl in teak wood. So anyway, I left and got home Christmas Eve of 1945.
And I want to ask you about that, but it strikes me as you describe these dealings with this Japanese family. Here, you're a Marine. You've been fighting the Japanese for years. Your government just blew that city to shreds, and now you're befriending this people. What kind of contrast was that, and did that leave a much better taste in your mouth?
It's an interesting point. I often thought, here we were killing each other and getting ready to invade Japan, and the Japanese were brainwashed to a point where the Marines were going to rape all the women, and went on and on like that. But you can't imagine how quickly things changed. The next thing you know, you had Marines with Japanese girlfriends after a couple of weeks. And the little kids, the little girls particularly, geez, I wanted to bring that one little Yazaki girl home with me. She was as cute as a bug. But here we were, war's over. And the next thing, now that wasn't with everybody. There were some of the southern boys that had serious trouble. And there were some bad incidents. You know, that was one big noticeable change.
What about the devastation in Nagasaki? What could you see, and how did that strike you? Was it hard to look at what had happened to that city?
Well, it was either them or us, the way a lot of us looked at it. As I said, we were preparing to invade Japan, and we were training on Saipan. So coming in there with the war over, a lot of the damage was done by the B-29s. And the structure of Japanese housing at that time was such that cities were in flames after the 29s. The actual bomb, I have a picture at home, and it's unbelievable, the destruction of the area. I would say 100-yard circle. And the perimeter is, I forget how high the bomb was when it went off, but it's unbelievable. It made an impression on all of us. But war's war, and the war's over, and it's amazing. To answer your question, yes, we were impressed with the horrible destruction. We saw a lot of the population that were injured and burned, and that was bad, but they estimated we would have lost 1 million men, so it depends on how you look at it. It's quite a controversial subject. It still is.
Well, you mentioned getting home Christmas Eve, 1945. How special was that for you?
Boy, that was special. I volunteered to stay aboard the ship and work in the radio shack. Well, there wasn't much to do up there. So I went ashore, and my brother, who was in the air corps, he was enlisted, and they had a hotel in Santa Monica. He and my best buddy, a Marine, Easy Aldridge from Georgia, were at the ship when we landed. Easy had a way of finding out, and he found out I was coming home, and they were there. So we had a big celebration, and unbelievably, we ran into a captain who I worked with in Minneapolis, and he was at the Zephyr Hotel, which was officers, Air Corps officer, preparing to discharge. So we had some great times. I was there for probably 5 days. I bought a train, headed for Minneapolis, got malaria on the train, and I was riding home with a gal that was in the Marine Corps. Nice gal, very attractive too. But she got off the train, and they took me to the hospital in Kansas City. And I was there overnight, and then I went back home. She lived in Minneapolis also, so she's kind of stuck by me till I got home.
Well, and a couple years later, another special lady would come into the picture. How did you meet Beatrice?
I used to fish every day, and my dad had bought a big house on the lake, Lake Calhoun in Minneapolis. And I met a couple down there, and they said, "Bud, you're still single?" I said, "Yeah, you're 26 years old." Well, make a long story short, they introduced me to a good friend of theirs who was teaching school in Duluth. She would take the train down from Duluth to Minneapolis. I'd pick her up. My parents just loved her. So my dad said to me, "Bud, you've had a lot of girlfriends since you got, but don't let this one get away." So that's how I met her.
Sounds like the best advice you ever got, huh?
It was, undoubtedly. Best thing I ever did.
Well, and I'm sure your kids and grandkids will agree to that. But another thing that I want you to touch on, I know we're short on time, but you discovered after she died many years ago, some things that had belonged to Leonard Sill. Who is Leonard Sill, and why was it so important for you to honor him the way that you did? Tell us that story.
Leonard Sill and my first wife, Bea, grew up in Chippewa Falls, Wisconsin. They went through kindergarten, all through grade school, all through high school, all through college, and married previous to the war. Leonard went overseas, and a week before the war ended, he was shot down and was killed. So I told you how I met Bea, and then we were married, and after Bea died, I was going through some stuff up in the attic, and I found these boxes. I knew they were there, but we hadn't paid much attention. So I found out that he had two sisters, no children. They had no children, only Bea, but he had two sisters in Florida. So I called them and asked them if they'd like to have these, and they said they'd love to have them. So I shipped them to them. They invited me down there a couple times to come visit. Then I discovered later that I neglected to get his flag in the box. So I contacted a friend of mine with the Avenue of Flags here in Visalia, where they fly 1,800 flags, more than that, each one representing a serviceman. So I asked if we could fly a flag for Leonard. I said, "He's not from California." I said, "Doesn't matter where he's from." So his flag is flying. He's number 752, I think. And I thought that that would be a nice thing. And his flag flies not far from where Bea is buried. And so that's the story there.
And I think anyone hearing that is touched by that story and by your determination to honor him and what he meant to your wife. And I don't want to put any words in your mouth, but to wrap that element up, it strikes me. Here's a man who was killed in World War II, and over 400,000 Americans were, and many of them were Marines that you served with. In fact, I think if we go back to the day you signed up, you said how many guys you signed up with, eight of them?
Signed up with eight, and four were killed.
And you're honoring Leonard that way. Is part of that of a recognition of the fact that you and he easily could have traded places, that you could have been one of those 400,000 plus?
Very much so, you know, but it wasn't entirely that. It was just that looking back at how close Leonard and B were. In fact, we had a picture of Leonard and she was in kindergarten, he was in first grade, a cute picture there holding hands. And I just knew that Leonard was her first love, and they loved each other dearly. So that's probably the reason I thought it would be nice to have his flag out there where B was.
In closing, is there anything else that you want people to know about World War II and what you and all your fellow Marines did?
I gave a talk recently to a group of fourth graders from St. Paul's School, and they were brought out to the big mural out on Muni that depicts us, the greatest generation. They gathered around me, and one little boy said, "Tell me about the battles." I said, "No, how many can spell freedom?" And they all spelled freedom. And out of all this, you'd be amazed at the answers I was given about freedom and what it meant to their families. So in the final analysis, freedom doesn't come cheap. And by that, as you say, all the millions that have lost their lives in all the wars we've fought, there aren't any good wars. I hope the next war they give, they send out invitations and nobody comes. I know that World War II was very necessary. There are other wars that I don't think were necessary.
Well, thank you for serving our country, and thank you for telling us about it.
Well, thank you. Glad to meet you, Paul.
Once again, the pleasure is all mine. I do want to thank Jack Mann of Visalia and Rick Turner at the Visalia Country Club letting me know about Bud's story. That's Bud Erickson, 92 years old, and no, Bud is not what's written on his birth certificate. If you want to know what is, go to kmjnow.com. And if you see Bud at the Visalia Country Club this week, maybe you can try to get him to elaborate even more on some of those stories he shared. Next week, another Marine who's also in the Fresno Athletic Hall of Fame. Don't miss Coach Claire Slaughter next Saturday. Thanks for listening to Hometown Heroes today on KMJ.